and we can edit this. So I think that what we should do is, it's actually the 19th of May now, isn't it? It's actually a really beautiful day. In fact, it rained a lot this morning. It's been really showering all day. And we're here in our ICFA office on Charing Cross Road with myself and Bonnie Maranka and Chris Rawls. And this is Bonnie's final day in London. And she's been here since the 8th of January. Did you arrive on the 8th of January? 6th of January?
The 9th.
The 9th of January. Right. And now she's leaving tomorrow. So she's feeling, she's in that mood when you're just about to try and get on the plane. This is just, I'm just chatting actually to get into it. But one of the things that I often think about going backwards and forwards from the US is there are times when I've been so resistant to actually managing to get on the plane because it's so psychologically difficult. Mm-hmm. I've actually kind of thought I wouldn't get there. And the worst time, you're not going to have this, was the election in 1997, just before the Blair government was elected. I went to the US about a few days beforehand, and it was the last time that the IRA tried to actually stop London. They managed to completely close the M25 and totally close all the traffic in London, and everything was shut, and there were no planes going. And I was completely rerouted, and I spent half my day going to Newark and all kinds of other places. God knows where I went, actually, but I finally managed to get to Washington. So that's a very roundabout way of getting us into it. And the reason why I've invited Bonnie here today is because I don't feel I've really had any chance to speak to her this whole 5 months. And I particularly haven't had a chance to talk to her, really, or talk to you, about what it is that's come out of this last few months for you. And really, that's the purpose of this conversation, not to be publicly edited, but for us to just put on record so that we'll look back at it or listen back at it and think, what was it, personal and professional, that's actually made an impression over this period? And I think that's a thing worth us, you know, just talking about.
Do you mean, for example, like literally in terms of the projects I did? How exactly do you mean, or the works that I saw, or related to the Leverhulme and the lectures?
Anything.
In what sense?
I mean, what is it over the last few months? No, well, I don't think it needs to be quite as specifically focused on as that. For instance, I think the last few months, I've learned a huge amount from you, for instance, in the last few months, both about collaboration. We've had some very deep conversations about art and performance. And so one of the things that's really come out of the last few months for me has been the value of having colleagues coming to take up professorships for a few months. People who are not actually part of your everyday work environment, they're bringing other viewpoints, they're free to see other work. You suddenly begin to kind of open up your discussion about art and performance with them in a way that you just don't do in the everyday. Mm-hmm. And I've seen you, so things sort of, your preoccupations until now kind of fall away, and for you to be able to start thinking much more openly. So it might be that. Mm-hmm. It's been a very good space to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it takes, you know, many different levels and many different ways of putting the pieces together, because on the one hand, there's the formality of being here and fulfilling the terms of the Leverhulme and what I had agreed to in terms of, you know, our collaboration for the project that we had proposed. So a lot of it was really taken up by going to, a lot of my time was devoted to actually interacting with colleagues in the UK on different levels. For example, with giving actual lectures and meeting in front of faculty and students, going to different parts of the country like Leeds or York, going to Wales, going to things like the Live Art Festival, you know, in February, and the lectures at Queen Mary, and then a couple of the sort of classes that I gave with some students, classes on editing and arts criticism, and also on ecologies of theater. So in terms of that part of it, which is more academic, one of the essential points in the Leverhulme was really to interact and to be part of a certain kind of faculty culture. So that gave me an opportunity to meet a lot of the British faculty, who, some of whom in the past have written for PAJ, and some of whom will in the future write for PAJ, but it also gave me a great insight into the English academic system and also other forms of scholarship. And I guess what struck me in that sense was the, well, learning about the practice-based practice-based PhDs, which I haven't quite made up my mind about yet, but it's an intriguing concept. And actually, having just come from Copenhagen, I had a very interesting conversation with someone who had been to the Academie der Kunst in Berlin for various EU discussions about making curriculums and programs more uniform. And I was talking to her about this practice-based dissertation. She was asking me about practice-based PhD. She was asking me about the difference for me, like if I lecture or if I give a class, in terms of different forms of knowledge or knowing. And I'm jumping to that because recently we just got an email from Maria Fusco, however she pronounced her name, about an arts writing discussion that's forthcoming about, and the question of knowing and thinking and performance. So somehow all these things are coming together in terms of being in Europe and getting a wider sweep. We don't have a practice-based dissertation. We also don't have so much emphasis on what's called practices here. I don't think that we have a kind of concerted effort within the university in terms of social practices or the social necessarily. I found that it was very different to be with people and to hear forms of scholarship that are really organized and generated often by the funding and research plans of the government. So that was interesting, learning that system. Now, okay, that's one component. Our project was really very different because it had to do with performance drawing. Mm-hmm. And like you, I don't often have an opportunity to collaborate with people from other countries or even around the United States. Much of the work I've done has been alone in terms of my own research or publishing, except for teaching. So I think this was really good to generate international projects. And not only that, to get at least the first phase done of what would be considered a valuable project in our field internationally, which is to do a book of performance drawings. So I'm giving a long answer because there are different components of the project itself. And later on, we can get to talking about what we saw and talked about and the kinds of works that were valuable. But there were two very different sides of my project, in addition to the editing, the book projects, all the other things I worked on as part of my project and the beginnings of other research, for which I don't know where I'll end up or what I'll begin to write about. I need to put all this together in the summer.
Do you think we have in the United States quite a similar notion of the importance of the scholar in public life? Because that's one of the ideas that the Leverhulme really puts forward, that we bring people because public benefit is really established or generated through having somebody come and give lectures in different places, and we feel that that's a kind of very important part of keeping a rich public life going.
Mm-hmm. Well, various people have talked in recent years about the loss of the public intellectual in the United States. I mean, obviously, Susan Sontag was the outstanding example of that. Because our universities have music series, they have lecture series, film series, there's always the chance, if the public hears about it, to the degree that it happens more in a small college town rather than a university in the center of the city. But still, even in New York City, there are many, many public events to which the public is invited, or they can be on mailing lists, and they take place within a university. As far as the public intellectual, it seems more now in the current construction of society that they're more likely to be law professors or economics professors or foreign policy people or, say, at one time, Russian experts, Chinese experts. You don't see people from the university called upon to make comments about cultural policy And in the United States, we have no real cultural policies that are discussed that are part of any of our elections, and a no culture minister. So it's not like France, for example, or Germany, where everything is so hotly debated, every monument, every change of policy.
Yeah. Or Britain. I mean, that's why, to a certain extent, you're seeing the people thinking about government funding, because it's part of public policy, and so cultural policy is part of public policy, and it's in the public domain. And we don't really, it's highly privatized intellectual thought, in a sense, and cultural thought in the United States, I think. I mean, it really struck me when I went to live there that the role of the public intellectual and the role of the university has become much more sidelined. As you say, it's much more now the law professor and the international policy professor. Those are the kinds of things that you get public commentary on in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because what it reminds me of is Anthony Grafton's here at the moment, and he's giving a talk in York tonight, actually.
He's
a very close friend of Bill's, and he's written about, he's talked about that and the notion of the arts being entirely sidelined from public life in the United States now. And in fact, when he has postgraduate students coming to take up posts, they're really thinking, what economic benefit will this make to them? So they're getting less and less students actually taking up courses because of that. But did you find did anything surprise you about the universities here or the way that people relate to scholarship? Is there a different mix, do you think? I mean, the practice-based PhD is one of them.
Yeah, I think that's really a very strong difference, because I've been aware that, for example, a place in Zurich, one institution in Zurich, offers PhDs to artists, because I've known of at least one American artist who's going there. So I imagine this perhaps might be a drift, might be a change in the field. But the thing is, we don't really have practice-based dissertations, practice-based PhDs. If you're getting a PhD, you need to know two languages. You have a certain kind of you have a rigorous set of courses that you're taking for 2 or 3 years, comprehensive exams.
Yeah.
And it's basically for scholars. I don't really understand why an artist needs a PhD, and I don't understand how a person can get a PhD with no courses.
But nobody has courses here. PhD's not, nobody has courses. It's just dissertation. It's not, it's got nothing to do with courses. In America, it's professional training. It's long professional training. It's a very different kind of university system. But anyway, it is very interesting. But just going around the country, for instance, to York, you've been to York, to Leeds, to Aberystwyth. Right, are those the three places you gave talks? You didn't go to Exeter in the end, did you?
No, but I've been to Exeter in the past, giving a lecture, or to Roehampton in the past. So I have been going around to.
Yeah.
School. Well, I mean, one of the obvious characteristics is that in such a small country, there seem to be much more cooperative, collaborative projects than can exist in a place like the United States, even within New York. I can't say that City University at the Graduate Center is working on any collaborative projects with Columbia or with NYU, for example. Our institutions are very separate, in the same way that theaters often are not, or they collaborate with some. I mean, they contribute to each other with some resources, but they don't. Each entity kind of produces its own thing. So I think, the social and the collaborative in a small country where you kind of know each other, has its positive aspects. But I can also imagine how difficult it would be to function outside on the margins then, if you're doing something that other scholars don't think is valuable, or that your government is not really pushing as a research interest. I feel that there's a lot of social engineering going on in the university system in terms of the division of labor and resources. And I don't know, how do you think scholars and artists respond to that?
I think that's one of the big questions. We've started to think about it. I've started to think about it myself, because the role of the individual scholar has become quite marginalized, or the role of the individual artist. Everything has moved towards collaboration and large team-based projects. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a real, I think that's a real loss. Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Why have things moved toward teams and collaboration?
I'm not really sure. I think it's a deeper cultural question, but I'm not really sure what the answer is. Mm-hmm.
Is it to give more money and involve more institutions as a form of oversight, better oversight?
I don't think it's to do with better oversight, although I'm sure that's actually part of it. It's interesting you should ask the question, because within this culture it seems absolutely self-evidently obvious that that's what you would do. I mean, it's a very collaborative culture, so that's part. Those things were already set up before we got this particular instance, you know, of collaborative work. But that's been going on, this particular kind of collaboration, really for about since the last Labour government came in. We went through this very long period of exceptionally fragmented and modularised individualism under the Thatcher government. And the Labour government came in on a wave of new kinds of collaboration, and also bringing what they call stakeholders within the culture in. I think it's what it's to do with is, it's to do with trying to work out the value of cultural projects in terms of social benefit. And if you're going to really work out how to fund them in terms of social benefit, you have to work out how we're able to make them really work within a kind of wider social project. And the government, and not just the government, but the universities, also wanted to make sure from the late 80s onwards that everybody had a voice within the public domain. And that's part of what the practice PhD is, so that you don't just have scholars, for instance, or lawyers making comments about and contributing to social policy. You enable artists to come to the table by also enabling them to have the same kind of qualifications, same kind of voice. So everybody kind of makes a contribution to cultural policy.
I know, but is it necessary for them to have a PhD then? A PhD should really be, you know, one of the most difficult things to attain in the world of education.
But it's not very hard in America, I have to say.
A PhD? Sure it is, with not only the dissertation, but 2 or 3 years of coursework.
Yeah, but it's not.
It's
not, I mean, very, very many people have PhDs in the United States, and mm-hmm. and they're very much to do with your, and there are many kinds of the way in which I see that they work is that there's a lot of training and mentoring, and you also go through courses, so there's oversight, and you're graded at every possible way, and the dissertation is a kind of outcome of all of the learning and training you do. So here it's very different. The undergraduate curriculum is still incredibly important here, and seem to be at a high level. Mm-hmm. And by the time you get to PhD, it's intended that you simply do that last 3 to 5 years of personal work, which is only overseen through supervision. So you kind of done that, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I just don't see how a person, a young person would be so self-directed to take to create a program of research and study that would be as valuable as taking, say, 6 courses a year or something for 2 or 3 years.
You already do those courses in your undergraduate work, you see here, because it's a specialist program. You don't go mm-hmm. to university to do a generalized course. Mm-hmm. You do that in the sixth form. You do, as soon as you go to university, like mm-hmm. becoming medical degrees and law degrees are undergraduate degrees here as well.
Mm-hmm. So then you're skipping the MA as well.
Yeah.
Well,
it's
hard to, it's just a very different system. But the question is, I guess, what are the many kinds of research that people are doing, or is the system forcing people into a certain kind of research that's for utilitarian benefits? Mm-hmm. That everything. I mean, I have found in learning about the system that there seems to be a great amount of emphasis on figuring out what the results are, mm-hmm. who benefits,
social
how you
benefit,
measure
yeah.
things, it's very utilitarian and very socialist oriented in a way.
It is, yeah.
So it means that there must be a certain push toward a certain kind of research project as opposed to another. It reminds me of something like the big MacArthur Genius Awards in the United States. You know, they in the past I have heard that, you know, if you do a certain kind of art, that certain very formal or whatever, you know, you might not be prone to getting this award as if you work in the community, you know, and doing so-called community-based or ethnic type of work. I mean, personally, I'm against that form of that kind of philosophy.
Because it feels like social engineering. I think it's a really big debate here, so I guess you have to kind of watch this space, because you know, I think everybody would agree that at the moment, there are always debates about it, but I think there's a particular debate about it at the moment. You know, how do we go forward from here with these big collaborative projects? And then the situation for us as well is, how do we deal with the European institutions, and should we be collaborating with them, and should we have the same kind of system, as you said, all over Europe? So it's a kind of interesting debate, but I'm not sure that anybody really knows what the answers to it are at the moment. But it's also that we've moved into what they call the knowledge economy. So, you know, we've moved away from industrial manufacturing, and now we have the kind of information and knowledge economy. Mm-hmm. And that's where the universities are now, I think, as well.
Well, what I was describing about this talk, about this meeting in Berlin in the Academy der Kunst, that a Danish woman who's an architect and in urban planning had attended, and when they were discussing cultural issues, it was really about the question of, you know, knowledge and I mean, for example, like she said, acting wasn't really a form of knowledge.
And what
then
is
I was
knowledge?
Questioning, yeah. What? How does one define knowledge? And in the new societies in the future, how will they consider arts a form of knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
You look at the kinds of questions that are asked on questionnaires of teacher evaluation or project evaluation, and they're clearly written by people with education or social sciences degrees. They don't know how to measure the arts, and they can't be measured in the same way. So the question is, what forms of knowledge will be acceptable in the future? Will art just remain kind of a field among artists? Will it, you know, be linked to some other forms of political economy to justify it? We don't really know where all this discussion is going.
No, I think you're right. I mean, those questions of knowledge, I'm sure they are the real questions. What forms of knowledge does art produce? And is it knowledge, and can it be quantified, and is it valuable? And they're the things that are very much driving the situation here at the moment. And you know, and it is also extremely bureaucratic. But it's interesting, and it's very interesting to come from another culture, isn't it? Because then you see that it isn't self-evident. It can be done in a different way, and there are things we have to learn from each other, I think, as well, very much.
Yeah, and also coming here, one realizes how literary a culture it is, as opposed to being a very visual culture, which is not to say that, you know, Britain has strong visual artists. But the visual culture is not really readily apparent in the theater. It's certainly apparent that people read here. I mean, I cannot recall another country where if I'm sitting on the tube or the metro or the subway, that if you take, the two sets of seats facing you are about, let's say they're 12, 6 and 6, that probably 9 or 10 people will be reading. And people actually go out of their way to get a newspaper or some kind of literary material that's sitting on another seat or something. And then, of course, I've really listened to the BBC quite a lot, and there are books being read, there are radio plays, there are novels, all sorts of things, which just don't exist in the United States. We're not really a very literary culture.
No, not at all. Much more musical culture, I think. I mean, that's what I think.
Musical.
The sort of condition of music, very musical culture, don't you think?
Visual and our
and
our theater. I mean, but I meant to say music. Yes, that's the dominant culture, but also our theater is very, our performance is very visually oriented, our theater very visual and media oriented, and I've not really found that to be the case in the various kinds of performances and productions I've seen.
Okay, well, let's move on to what we've seen then, and what impressions that really gives you about what people think, if it does, about what's going on here and what kinds of productions come to London as well, because they're international productions too, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
What stands out, for bad or good?
Well, I mean, it's clear that the British theater is dealing with certain very prominent local and global issues. For example, the Tricycle had an entire series of about 10 plays, and they're also already published plays about Afghanistan. And they start in the historical period of the 19th century. On the other hand, you have plays that are very local, like England People Very Nice of Richard Bean. Then you have the British repertoire. So, of course, there's several Shakespeares, and there were also, in the opera, a couple of Dido productions of Katie Mitchell, and then Marlowe, of course. So you have this vast repertoire in the English language, and a great a number of contemporary writers. What I didn't see was a kind of new experimental faces and names and different modes of working in the theater. Now, of course, there could be so much that I have missed, and I hear that the shunt performances are interesting. But I mean, I did see probably 40, 50 events while I was here, and a great mixture of things. Now, a good few dozen of them were in Scotland at Live Art, but I have a pretty good grasp from reading, going to bookshops, talking to people, and seeing things of what a season consisted of. It was so disparate that I can't say that it had overriding themes, because at the Royal Court there was also a series devoted to plays having to do with 20 years after the event of 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So things were very, disparate, and there's no one overriding theme.
Do you think you need to be, in a sense, one needs to be here longer? Because one does one ever. I'm trying to think of periods when, I've been in New York or something, and do I really get... Sometimes you kind of pick up an idea, and sometimes you don't really get an idea of what very much kind of...
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there are lots of festivals here, like the Brighton Festival, which we were at, a couple of weeks ago. A lot of work comes from Germany, particularly, and Holland, and Italy over here as well, doesn't it? I mean, the Spill Festival.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, because I would say certainly New York is no longer a place where you get this kind of festival that's really for more edgy and experimental traditions. Of course, the people come from the Schaubühne to New York, the Théâtre du Soleil comes, big groups like that. But you don't get a big venue for, say, Rimini Protocol, who came from Germany. One of the things that's really clear to me is that it's not really possible as an American critic to really have this huge cosmopolitan sense of theater, because number one, we don't get it in the United States, and number two, one would have to live abroad to cover Eastern Europe and the continent to see the big shows in at least Berlin and Germany, and to some extent, Germany, Austria, to some extent, France, and then Poland, and then an odd thing perhaps in Budapest or maybe Sweden or something like that. But I'm not sure that British critics reflect that either. When I meet critics on the continent, they know much more about, like a German critic would know much more about what's going on the continent. I think what always amazes me in Europe is how local each culture actually is and how little people know about another culture, how little people in any one theater culture know about another culture, except what comes on festivals. But you certainly get more festivals here than we do of this type of work. So I've always said for recent years that it's very hard to get a theater education in New York now.
Yeah,
we're just not bringing in, the theater companies and theater artists.
What about theaters themselves? Because and we'll turn to visual art in a minute. But I was just thinking that when we went to see you and me and Maria, we're all at Rimini Protocol, part mm-hmm. of the Brighton Festival. It's a fantastic company from Berlin. But it was also in a beautiful theater, this beautiful 19th century theater, the Theatre Royal, mm-hmm. which is really wonderful. Yes. I love those old theaters. Mm-hmm. And then we went to Berlin and we went to see the Berliner Ensemble. And that theater is just a gem, isn't it? It's mm-hmm. just wonderful to see things in those historical spaces.
Mm-hmm.
That for me was the real highlight, actually, this last few months, seeing Robert Wilson's Threepenny Opera there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Rather than always having to sit in these run-down, poverty-stricken spaces for work, like in New York or maybe here as well.
I like St. Anne's, though. I mean, that's a wonderful space.
Yes.
And I think that's someone we could collaborate on. I was thinking, yeah, we can collaborate with them as well in our usual way. Can we work with them? Or the performing garage is still really
those
great.
Those are great spaces, yeah. But the problem is that we don't have a lot of middle-sized theaters or really bigger theaters so that companies can have a longer run and have larger audiences.
Yeah.
Europe has also many more urban spaces that are claimed for the public, whereas mm-hmm. ours might be torn down by a developer and claimed for real estate. That's a big issue.
I think that is a big issue. What about visual arts? I mean, you've seen as much visual art as you have theatre.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
mm-hmm.
is anything? What strikes you there, if anything?
Well, I did see the Tate Triennial and some of the shows at the at the Tate Modern, for example, the Russian show and
the
Rodchenko and Popova. And I had a chance to go to many of the galleries in Hackney or some in the center of the city.
You actually spent quite a lot
of time doing Hoxton Square, yeah.
So, Hoxton galleries.
So, well, you know, the thing about the international scene is that a lot of the work looks the same everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, but still for me, people like Tacita Dean, mm-hmm. you know, are very striking in terms of the triennial. And actually, in Copenhagen, though I wasn't able to go, Mike Hunter, who had the very interesting installation when you first walk in at the Tate Modern, he had a big show there at the State Museum. I particularly liked the work that was done at the Drawing Center. I thought that
at the Drawing Room.
The Drawing Room that it seemed
the
to
Monica,
be very
what's Monica,
her name, Monica? Grazina or something like that, and. That seemed to be very high quality and their program in general.
No, they're really interesting, definitely.
Yeah, and also I have to say, I mean, I admire what Lois Keaton has
done. I was going to say about live art development.
Live
agency.
Art. In fact, Live Art is going to distribute a few of our titles which fit their list. And I'm happy that she's actually probably going to expand. Or at least, you know, rethink and see how the distribution can be wider for her book, for the publishing aspect of it. But I'm not as committed to a certain kind of body art as I am to different kinds of performance, perhaps that have more formal concerns than autobiographical or body art concerns. I've moved away from that in my own thinking. But I think an organization like that, that has a public component, that actually produces works, and then even multiples, and then has the publishing component, is something really, really very valuable. And on the other side, I have to say, while I was here, I was also able to make a financial arrangement with Richard Goff at the Center for Performance Research, who will now have the back issues of PAJ from 1976 to the present and be able to supply the UK and international outlets with the issues of our journal. And he also is thinking about distributing books, you know, in a wider way. These things take a lot of time. They're very labor intensive. Book publishing is not something you go into to make a lot of money, and it takes a lot of thinking about how to get the books around. I also had occasion to go to Samuel French and see the store and reinstitute an old relationship, and they're going to order more of the PAJ books. And I went as well to the National Theater Bookshop, and they also are going to beef up their list, because I'd been felt very disconcerted in my last couple of trips not seeing enough of our books around.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that one has to constantly renew these ties and make sure that the important outlets know about things. So I say that to the point, to address the point that the trip and the stay here and the relationships have been so valuable in every way, in this business way, in terms of PAJ and forging collaborations with people who run your organizations here, and then with you, this ongoing phase of mm-hmm. the book that we will hopefully eventually produce after a second phase or third phase of research, and then there was all the academic side. It's hard to reflect now. It's been 4.5 months. I've got to unpack, put all my papers together, see where this is going.
Yeah.
But a lot of things came about, and there were a lot of ties forged, and that was really the essential part of the Leverhulme.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we got a huge amount from you, and also from your milieu, from your friends, from your from the artists that you know, bringing Alison Knowles here and bringing Meredith Monk here, and your generosity in opening up our friendship with them, and their incredible generosity, both of those women, were absolutely extraordinary, meant a huge amount. And it also helped us to forge wider relationships with other universities. It was a very busy time, actually, I think. It's been very packed. But I kind of see it as a, not just as a start, but as I think one needs to keep continuing those dialogues and those relationships in order for them to get the most benefit. It's got this word as well. Yes. We've got these kind of current words in Britain, benefit is one of them, I think.
No, but I think that, you know, we go into the second phase of our book project, Performance Drawings, over the summer.
Yeah.
See where we are by the early fall, and really lot of it done by the end of the year.
Then I'll come to New York in the spring, and then we'll hopefully have it, and we'll work then. But the thing I do want to ask you, though, is we talked a little bit about the way in which drawing has become, as these things kind of take off in different countries, a really big thing in Britain at the moment. There's a huge amount of interest in drawing itself, isn't mm-hmm. there?
And that it hasn't in the U.S. to any great extent. There's no major book on performance drawing, no major exhibition. But that's what's interesting, that we might intervene in the field in such a way to really make this an international project. And to go back to what we've been talking about earlier in terms of the public nature of this mm-hmm. and also the local and the international, I mean, that's one of the chief things that we're forced to confront. Can we do
Absolutely.
A book of just, American, British, and Europe? To what extent do we have to include... Should we include Latin America, Asia, South Africa? I mean, there are important artists who fit our concept all over the world. But the question is, what can we? How can we mm-hmm. bring this together? Does one feel compelled to have every project address the global subject?
And equally, something that we've talked about, and actually in the last couple of weeks, it's also been a subject discussed in different ways in the public media here, is about what things are held in Britain. What do we hold in terms of archives? What do we archive? Where are things held? What are collections? How so much goes out of this country? Often it's bought in the United States, artists' papers and artists' collections. And you realize when you go to the United States just how rich the depth of collections and archives is. And I think we have that in some fields, like, the Renaissance or medieval or even 19th mm-hmm. century. But for contemporary art, we don't have mm-hmm. nearly as much in terms of our kind of archival holdings mm-hmm. and our collections at all.
Yeah. And actually, it's very interesting because, mentioning this to a number of people, the project of performance drawings, people don't really know what it is, which is also interesting. It makes
it
because it is fresh and new, and it's not yet defined, and people don't know what it is, but they're very intrigued. But also, nobody knew, you know, in the 60s and 70s, how much performance would begin to dominate the arts. The notion of performance, spectacle, performer, would become so central to visual arts. Even our major institutions like the Museum of Modern Art or the Whitney, they've come very slowly to, you know, to recognizing visual art. And still, this is why there's such an imbalance, I mean, to recognizing performance. This is why there's such an imbalance in terms of study. Because our field has changed so vastly. What does it mean to be a theater major? Or what does it mean to study performance? How long will these traditions of theater and performance in the visual art tradition be kept separately? When are we going to have more comprehensive? I mean, in a way, the arts departments are very backward here and in the U.S. because we should be having like a total kind of arts major or arts study, and also arts critics, whereas we don't have people really capable of writing about several different forms, and we don't study in a way that you would know dance, important dance, music, performance art, theater.
So I think part of the thing, not the answer to that, but the response to that might also be that we in this country would like to develop that at doctoral level, because we haven't had such an advanced range or spectrum of PhD work, and we could do it at that level. But whether we will be able to, I don't really know, because I totally agree with you. It is very split, and art schools have such a very different kind of approach to the curriculum, both here and in the US. For me, in a way, more enjoyable, more open kind of approach, not so hidebound by particular kinds of
risk-taking and more independent.
More
I find that there seems to be a kind of overriding disciplinary sense in the way that even theater scholars think of themselves, what you can or can't do. It just seems to be restrictive and patriarchal in a way, and self-inflicted.
And I think one of the things that happened here was that the curriculum in the arts changed an enormous amount in the last, I don't know, 15 years in relation, and it moved more towards being a kind of, the repertoire was more a kind of experimental repertoire, and all kinds of things have been forgotten as a result of that too. Actually, I think you've put your finger on something very important, that the whole notion of what's slightly outside, what's slightly left field at the moment is perhaps the most interesting place to really look at, rather than, you know, the things that seem to be, they were once experimental, but now they've come absolutely mainstream. Mm-hmm.
But you know what, to speak to that, I think what we did, the event here, the UAL event of bringing Meredith, I mean, that's really completely out of mainstream thinking in Britain. The whole notion of art and the spiritual. Now, that's a whole other topic, but that does not fall under the kind of social practices and the thin way that might be determined within a bureaucratic institution giving out research money, and also trying to get a book published with a publisher. I mean, there are, you know, much of the British book publishing is dominated by Routledge, and so that, of course, is determining the curriculum in terms of theater. But if we talk about these sort of outsider themes that independent scholars and collaborative groups could do, like this art and the spiritual and bringing Meredith here, it was shown to be that an enormous number of people are interested in thinking about work and practice this way.
Well, I think it's one of the new themes. I mean, I think in 2 or 3 years when we look back on this, we'll realise, it's one of the coming things. There's a big article in The Guardian about it yesterday, actually. It said, you know, it's the theme that's coming socially, whereas, you know, ecology was the one like 2 or 3 years ago, but this whole notion about the public domain and religion and spirituality is the one that's the most important politically as well now. But I think there are other things that we're not studying. I mean, to bring it back into the university and thinking about our own position as a research centre. For instance, collaboration, the history of recent art experiments, for instance, in Britain, there's very, very little in the historical record about that history at all. I mean, for instance, I mean, thinking about Alice and Anne Meredith coming here, and Vito Acconci visited last year, and we've also had Joan Jonas and Yvonne Rayner in this university this year. That generation's work is incredibly well known here. Mm-hmm. Their equivalents here are not anything like as well known globally. Mm-hmm. And there's very little work on them. And that there's a huge publishing and research venture to be done there. Mm-hmm. But that's not really being done, actually. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Boris Howarth died yesterday, mm-hmm. who was one of the founders of Welfare State. Mm-hmm. Very well known, important artist who very mm-hmm. little work has been done on.
Why is that? Why didn't your critics write books or essays on them?
They've been very marginal to British culture. I don't know. I mean, that's a very good question, and it would be mm-hmm. a great collaborative research project as well.
No, because, I mean, maybe that also addresses the fact of what's been fundable, what have been named justifiable or acceptable research projects in the university, I'm sure.
And I don't think it's just to do with the university. I think it's to do with dealers and galleries and all sorts of things mm-hmm. as well, and other institutions. When you think about, you know, the alternative institutions of New York, say from 60s onwards, and mm-hmm. And also I remember being at your flat once actually in New York and realizing that artists themselves, like Robert Motherwell and Andy Warhol and John Cage, had set up their own foundations when they realized their work was going to become extremely valuable in the international market, and mm-hmm. they give money, those foundations give money to other artists. I don't mm-hmm. think British mm-hmm. work has ever achieved that kind of mm-hmm. global reach. I mean, it's a lot to do with other cultural things. But
So not only because of the lack of published materials, but also because of the lack of philanthropy on the
yeah.
part of artists who become wealthy and then begin to support other
artists. We haven't had those
artists
kinds of
institutions.
Artists.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not but that level mm-hmm. of depth of capital
were there always small periodicals that in which articles appeared or interviews about these people?
There are, and in fact we saw when we were at Chelsea, one of the things that, another thing that we mm-hmm. did, we went with Alice and Knowles to the mm-hmm. Chelsea Art Library and spoke to Emily Glancy. They have kept a lot of periodicals. Again, a much smaller publishing culture,
mm-hmm.
and there are small periodicals, but not. I mean, there's no equivalent to PAJ. First of all, I would say, mm. Which is the extraordinary kind mm. of level mm. of depth mm. that you you've contributed to right across from visual art. I would say visual art, very importantly, with the mm-hmm. With the kind of monograph series that you've mm-hmm. done, but through experimental European writing. But write to dance and music.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking also of publications in the 70s like Avalanche or Art Writer or The Fox. There were so many good sort
it's
of downtown alternative publications in
yeah.
in the US.
And the NEA gives money to their archive, actually. I was on an NEA panel mm-hmm. Which gave money, really good money, to the kind of archiving of those projects as well. There
mm-hmm.
are a lot. There have been
mm-hmm.
a huge amount in the US. In fact, it always struck me just how much community resource there was amongst
yeah.
artists
yeah,
in
actually,
the
Yeah, actually there was. And it was just announced the new the head of the National Endowment for the Arts is a graduate of the Yale School of Drama.
Oh, really?
It's
Who
Rocco
it?
Landsman, a Broadway
okay.
producer.
Great.
But a serious, I think he was probably a classmate of Meryl Streep. Very well known and highly regarded.
That
He's become
good.
The new head of the National Endowment, which is a pretty good sign.
Yeah, it is a great
and
sign.
And then, of course, we've had arts councils with, you know, peer review on the local level and a real support for experimental work over the years.
I think there is, as we're talking, actually, I think there's some really good... some really good subjects to do with some of these things, like even the archiving of the arts, historical moments that could be really talked about between Britain and the US. There are really interesting collaborative projects actually there.
Yeah, because a lot of the events of the 60s and 70s took place in Britain, these fights
yeah.
against censorship, various movements for liberation. Many of the well-known American artists, as young artists, were involved here in.
Well, Carolee Schneeman, Lynn Tillman, I think, and Carla Reedy. I mean, I think of a lot of women who came. Mm-hmm. Some stayed as well.
And they were involved with sometimes people from France or other parts of Europe, and they would gather in London for these big events. Actually, I think in a way that with PhDs, I think that probably what should really be instituted in the university or in professional programs are more training of archivists.
I agree.
Rather than all these dissertations, you know, I think.
Yeah, let's. I agree. I've said that to lots of people. I think what we're probably not doing, and I don't know why we don't do it here, is training people in contemporary archival practices to really look at our recent history. We do it, definitely we do it with the Renaissance of the 18th century, with medieval, the huge holdings, and we have big projects in that area. But we have a real kind of blind spot, I think, around the contemporary. I think we've got great archives in this university, but I don't actually think there are any real programs that we've got around. There are programs around curating, but not around real archival work in the contemporary, you know, contemporary archives. Mm-hmm. We need to do that.
Yeah, I think so, because so many artists have preserved their archives. The question is, where are these paper goods going to go? How are they going to be organized? There's a huge...
Well, there was a talk about it yesterday with someone who I've actually begun to have a lot more respect for, a huge amount of respect for, Andrew Motion. And they were actually talking about poets' archives and writers' archives. And Jim Crace is a writer I immensely admire. Said that he'd had an offer from Birmingham University for his archive. And almost immediately, an offer had come in from the Harry Ransom Centre in Austin, and it was 10 times as much as the offer from Birmingham. And there was simply no question about where the work would go. Yeah. You know, he sent it to Austin.
Austin has a huge, Texas as well.
Houston
and Texas, they have huge archives for writers. Yeah,
enormous. So is that? I think you're right. I think that, and that also suggests to me that there are, whether they're really possible to do, good publishing projects here that are to do with some of the kinds of things you've done on PAJ, like the monograph projects you've done. Mm-hmm. I think of the Mary Lucier one, for instance, I particularly liked, actually. She was much less known to me.
Right.
And the you did one of Meredith Monk as well, hadn't you?
Yes.
You've done Meredith, you've done Yvonne Rainer. Who else did you do?
Gary Hill, Reza Abdo,
Hill,
Richard Foreman.
Why don't you continue that series? Is there money for it, or...?
We could do.
You could do a great British equivalent of that, really, European equivalent of that as well. We should really think about doing that here, but we're not. I can't think of anything.
No, I could do one any time a good idea pops up. We can do it. Oh, that could be the book for the year that we do one or two. Since we started that, there was one on Bruce Nauman as well. I mean, since we started that, of course, there's many more catalogs and different shows of people that we might have done, like, say, Tony Ursler. So it's a question of deciding who should we do.
Yeah.
Who should we give that treatment to? Mm. That's the art and performance, art plus performance.
Yeah, it's a lovely series.
Yeah, no, it's a great series and concept, and it could go on and on, actually.
It's a beautiful series, yeah. I really like it. Mm-hmm. Have we said enough? What do we want to say? Because it's 3:45, we've got to go and have tea. But I'm also trying to think, is there anything for the record that I want to say about what we've done? A couple of things quickly. I want to say that Bonnie had an incredible apartment in Highgate that owned by Paul Cronin, I haven't yet met Paul Cronin, but seems to be an extraordinary person with an amazing archive himself.
And young filmmaker.
I have a feeling he can't be that young, Bonnie.
He's in his late 30s. He's 37.
Is he? He shouldn't be. That's outrageous.
He's 37. Several of his books were published by Faber. interviews with Herzog.
I know, they're extraordinary. So that's been very interesting, and getting to know London in that way. Mm-hmm. Bonnie and I have walked some of the city churches. We didn't spend enough time doing that, but we will. We went to the opening of the Raven Row Gallery with the Ray Johnson Show, which was, I think, a total highlight and brilliantly curated.
Yeah. And that's an interesting case, too, because here he's been a treasure, but always an outsider, even in the New York art world, and yet not known here, really.
Not known here at all.
Kind of strange to
He's a particular kind, I think, in a sense of an American rambler, a certain sort of figure that inserts themselves into the wider culture that maybe these just turn up anywhere, but he, very extraordinary person. Mm-hmm. What else have we missed? Other things that have been seen? An incredible party in the Hawksmoor Church in Spitalfields.
Yes.
That night as well.
And we've also visited many of the churches in the city.
Yeah.
Following along our own interest in church architecture and
the Gothic,
spiritual life and
Hawksmoor and yeah. Wren and that. You've also talked to me as well about the kind of fabric of those religious buildings as public buildings in British life, how they relate to the contemporary as well. The whole notion of space, the space of the city, mm-hmm. and the space of architecture has been another very important mm-hmm. theme.
I've actually seen many more parts of London that I hadn't been to for many years or hadn't been really familiar with, for example, like Shoreditch mm-hmm. and Hackney. Because Queen Mary was located at Mile End, mm-hmm. I had occasion to go over to those areas much more, just to learn about them for the first time, because I had never had reason to go there in previous trips. And it had been a while since I'd been up north, but I didn't know the Highgate Hampstead area very well, or had ever spent much time around Hampstead Heath.
Pubs, Bonnie.
The pubs.
Bonnie is such a great
pubs.
Pub haunter.
Yes, I really like the pubs.
Local beer.
Yes.
Best cup of coffee? Where? Has there been one good cup of coffee?
Well, we've had a couple of good cups of coffee. We had that one around the corner from Raven Row.
Oh, that's
at
right.
That beautiful
we
place,
did.
And
that
also
really nice
at Monmouth.
Yeah, the Monmouth is great.
Yeah. Well, actually, England has changed a lot over the years since I've been here. It's very, very large compared to Manhattan. It's very, very cosmopolitan. And certainly what struck me is the really pronounced Muslim presence that you have here, and Eastern European.
Mm-hmm.
And also you get the sense of what's really interesting about England is that what's exported is this old village pub life and old English countryside and cottage, and yet there's a whole other side, like this Hackney side and Shoreditch and a string of Vietnamese restaurants or something, and then there's all of the new architecture in the city. I mean, I've enjoyed the various controversies, for example, the recent one with about the architecture and Prince Charles and this constant struggle about trying to build contemporary architecture in London.
Fear of the modern.
I mean, in France, they managed to put a cube in front of the Louvre, but here it seems like it's a really big issue about bringing contemporary architecture into things. And of course, now I'm here for this largest scandal with the Speaker of the House of Commons and all of the daily recriminations.
Actually, that's right. I mean, before we go, we should say, I mean, the political context of the last few months, mm-hmm. the post-Obama election, which has mm-hmm. been very interesting to be here and kind of watch the United States, and the utter scandal that we've descended into in Britain.
Yeah, and listening even this morning on the BBC with people saying that, you can't refer to one of the other people in the House of Commons, one of the other MPs, I guess, as you. Everything is Your Honourable. And people now saying on TV that this whole system may be just flushed away because it was outrageous, the expenses of some of the MPs, in a time when people are losing their jobs left and right. You one would think that there'd be a kind of worldwide revolution. Same thing in the U.S. too. It's outrageous the way politicians have become so corrupt every year.
I've got to say, and for the public record, the private record, I don't think that's what it's about at all. I think it's a pretty right-wing conspiracy to sink the Labour Party for good and make sure they never come back. It's been put forward by the Telegraph and the Mail. I mean, these are not huge expenses most of the time. Mm. They're hundreds or a few thousand pounds compared to what business has had. I think it really is a really frightening discrediting, and that the right will benefit from it.
Mm. Well, the thing is that it just goes to show, though, that, what perks are available and that they have been abused, even though, of course, it's only maybe in the mm-hmm. tens and twenties, thousands, but compared to the scandals of big business. But the fact is, it is the government and there is this kind of perhaps antiquated way of getting people in the House of Commons and the way that they relate to each other and not to the public. It's just one more thing. It seems that it seems that every day I've been here, there's some scandal or some attack on Gordon Brown, and it's just been really, you can see, it's been really difficult for the Labour Party.
It's the way governments end here. They're really they're horrible. I mean, when Margaret Thatcher was deposed in public, you know, in the House of Commons, it was
it's very mean in public and brutal in a way. Brutal politics.
Yeah, it's very brutal. Okay, is that that's a point to end there? The brutal politics of British life, but it's interesting.
Well, you know, we're all going to come out of this economic disaster anyway, and now the whole rhetoric has changed. That now we're into the green shoot philosophy, but I'm also impressed by the newspapers to some extent in terms of how they are organized around addressing people of many classes and the social, whereas you pick up the New York Times, it's always what William Gass called, you know, the Watch the Rich magazines. You know, it's every story is about some celebrity, what they're wearing, where they're vacationing, their houses look like. And I find, I've been very intrigued by the obituaries that are also written by people's friends. And the constant commentary, especially in the Guardian, by the public who contributes to the newspapers. So I find them I find everything actually trying to deal with the social and public culture. And there's just an awful lot of constant searching for some definition of the society. I find that kind of interesting.
It is.
Britain is constantly, that the London papers are constantly like critiquing, you know, who everyone is as a nation, who the nation is. Every different facet of public life, whether it's children's services or the railroads or the airport, there's just this constant fighting and struggle between different forces in defining the nation.
We're not one nation, indivisible under God. Oh, we're too. Shall we stop there? Because we've got to go and have tea now.
Yeah, that seems like a
very good place to stop. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Well, I just want to say for the record as well, it has been fantastic having you here. It's been really wonderful, and I think we'll think a lot about benefit, all the things we've benefited from, and it'll probably really inform anything else that we do, bringing other visitors, but we also hope you'll come back.
You know, and I think our next step would be not only to do this project and to have, you know, publication events on both sides of the Atlantic, but also that we pursue other interests and have an international conference.
Yeah, I think
that would
also
be
a very good idea,
very
as well.
Interesting, maybe to pursue the art and the spiritual or something else, or archiving or arts writing, anything
of our
interests.
Yeah. Good group of people that you've met here, and actually we should get them all really on a list and kind of make sure that we have got that. That's a good thing to do. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.